Yeah, among we still good? Still good?
We are good. I had forgotten to start the recording. All
right. Okay, that's good. Wallace Dodd Farr became the first person in the context of the Black community in Detroit to really begin to raise the notion of the Muslim tradition as a legitimate religious orientation for African Americans. He made it very clear that Christianity was not a religion that African Americans should follow. He went door to door with that message, and after a while began to meet in a kind of cottage style in the homes of people in that area. After a time, he had raised enough money that he was able to buy and rent a hall in which he established the first Muslim temple in Detroit, Michigan. His message was frightening. He talked about the white community as being the blue-eyed devils. He talked about the fact that these people were incapable of living with any other race than the Caucasian race. He made it clear that through trickery, brutality, murder, and violence, these white devils had robbed the Black community of its history and its identity. And he also filled in the blanks when it came to the nature of that history, that civilization, and that identity. Number one, he talked about the fact that primarily African Americans had come from a culture in Africa that was a highly developed civilization. It was a place where people lived in peace, each with the other. He reminded people that they had come from a history of religious orientation, which of course he believed to be the Muslim tradition. After a while, as the group grew and he began to develop the life of the temple, he began to have a message, and this was the message. He said that self-knowledge and a meaningful self-identity were absolutely essential for the survival of the Black race in America. He said that African Americans needed to build their own culture, their own economy. They needed to establish their own business to avoid the reality of being the last hired and the first fired. He was a man of enormous persuasive skills, and he began the Black Muslim tradition in America. It's interesting to note that Eric Lincoln, who is a significant Black historian, reminds us that Fard took various concepts of the Black, of the Muslim tradition, but mostly he just picked and chose what it was that served his purposes. Farr died in 1934, and he had in fact named a successor, a fellow by the name of Elijah Robert Poole. He's had a third grade education. His family had been sharecroppers in Georgia, and he came to Detroit to follow and to develop the work begun by Fard. This man, Robert Elijah Poole, ultimately became Elijah Muhammad, and he would preside over the development of the Black Muslim tradition in America for some 41 years. He had several interesting concepts that he advocated. Number one, he made the case that Fard, the guy who had come with the sales of raincoats and umbrellas, was in fact a reincarnation of Allah or God. He went on to say that that person, God, Allah, had appointed him, Poole, to be the divine messenger to the Black community in that time. He had some interesting concepts. Number one, he believed in hard work. He also believed in frugality. He suggested that the Black community avoid dependence upon alcohol and drugs, as well as indebtedness. He endorsed the notions of self-improvement and self-discipline. And across his 41 years, he created a monolithic concept known as the Black Muslim Nation. As a part of the development of the Black Muslim nation, Elijah Muhammad had some personal issues. It was Malcolm X who became a critic of Elijah Muhammad based upon several paternity suits and also some misappropriation of funds. Elijah Muhammad managed to survive Malcolm X. And as you all may know or remember, Malcolm X was ultimately assassinated as he spoke to a group of Muslims in a ballroom in New York City. Upon the death of Poole, now known as Elijah Muhammad, his son became the leader of the movement. And what is interesting about that transition of power is that his son was not the same cut of cloth as was his father. He was a much more peaceful man. He was more open to the white community. His father had made it impossible for a white person to join the Muslim tradition. Wallace Muhammad, the son of Poole, changed that. He also returned the notion of the temple to being a place of worship, a mosque, as over and against a moment of agitation toward violence. Wallace Muhammad presided over the Black Muslim nation until finally Louis Farrakhan, that's a name I'm sure many of you will recognize, emerged as a more conservative leader and separated himself from the traditions that had been begun by Muhammad and therefore the nation today lives in two foci, one that is more militant, aggressive, anti-Caucasian, and another that is more open and really reflective of the Muslim tradition. Why do I discuss all of that? This is my thinking. Beginning in 1940, the Black church in America began to suffer a credibility issue. The Black church simply was not working in terms of emancipating African Americans from the realities of racial bias, violence, and bigotry. And therefore, within the Black community, people began to look around for some alternatives. And interestingly enough, one of the alternatives that became most prominent was the whole notion of the Black Muslim movement. They had a high level of recruitment among young Black males who had grown impatient with being unable to find a job or develop their own personal career. They also recruited heavily in prisons where Black individuals had been wrongly convicted of crimes. The movement became an alternative to the life of the church. And as we moved into the 50s and the early 60s, with all of the issues that were emerging around Martin Luther King and the bombing of churches, et cetera, the Black Muslim tradition really was considered to be an option. Now, there are two ways to look at that moment. One is to have a moment of lament, a moment of frustration, a moment in which you say, therefore, the Black church is dead and over. That could be nothing further from the truth. There was a second option, and that was for the Black church to discover a Black theology that could provide insight, direction, and purpose, as well as support for the African-American community. The person who did that with the greatest degree of competence was a man by the name of James Cone. Now, he was a significant theologian who taught for years at the Union Theological Seminary in New York City, one of the more prestigious divinity schools in the country. He had come from an interesting background. Dr. Cone was born into the reality of the Jim Crow South. He was born in Arkansas. He lived in a small town known as Burden, Arkansas, where there were 400 Blacks and 800 whites. And as this young man grew up in that context, he began to have a question that would linger with him throughout the entirety of his life. And this was the question: how is it that good Christian white people can treat Black people so badly. You have to understand that his question had legitimacy because he grew up in a separate but equal sometimes community. He grew up in the Macedonia African Methodist Episcopal Church that was a segregated community, unable to break out of those walls. James Cone was a guy who had lived the experience of racism in his own life. In addition to the experience which he had had, he was a man who had impeccable academic credentials. He was a graduate of Philander College with a degree in the Bachelor of Arts. He went on to Garrett Theological School, where he earned a bachelor's degree in divinity. From there, he went on to Northwestern University, where he earned a master's degree in divinity, as well as a PhD. And then, of course, he journeyed to New York, where at first he was associated with Columbia University and ultimately with the Union Theological Seminary. James also experienced the man I mentioned briefly, Malcolm X. What you may or may not know about Malcolm X was that he himself went through a kind of personal conversion. And what I mean by that is this: under his early exposure to the Black Muslim movement, he too was a militant. He was someone who was interested in violence. He was opposed to any kind of white people interacting with the African-American community and or church. However, in one of his trips to Mecca, he discovered the reality of the Muslim tradition. And that was this: number one, Muslims believe in peace. Muslims believe that one must live in obedience to authority. Muslims are open to what they call the people of the book. And what that means is Jews and Christians, people who read the Old and the New Testaments. Malcolm X returned to the Muslim movement in America with a lot of questions. Why are we so anti-white? Why are we so anti-Jew? Why have we developed such a sense of violence in our living? And he concluded that the reason for that had to do with the frustration and the constant degradation of African-American people in America, primarily at the hands of the white community. His answer to that question was to create an economy, a culture, and a society totally and completely separate from the white community, not for the purposes of harassment, but for the purposes of survival. Malcolm X believed that the Black community needed to separate itself out of white systems, primarily for the purpose of survival. James Cone believed in that. And he also believed that it needed to find a theology that would give it direction and purpose. And so he began to write in his work, The Liberation of a People. He began to write about the fact that in his judgment, the reality of the white church in America had been part of the segregation and racist development. He took the white church to task in terms of living a lifestyle that was contradictory of the teaching of Jesus. Obviously, that did not make him very popular with the white church in America. But he did something else. He also said that the African American community, in terms of establishing this separate community, needed to try to do it in relationship to the values of the Christian faith. And of course, perhaps you remember that just a few minutes ago, I talked about how it was that Fard, the original founder of the Black Muslim movement in America, had said that Christianity was not the true religion of the African Americans. And so early on, James Cone was a person who was critical and therefore the target of many communities that were existing in the society of his time. He persevered. and he came up with two interesting terms. The first term was Black Power. Those words were first uttered by Stokely Carmichael, and they had about them a very militant, aggressive attitude. James Caan talked about Black Power as the ability of people to be truly emancipated, liberated, set free. He once said that Black Power is not so much an action as it was an attitude. And that attitude had to do with the essential value of an individual. He once wrote these words. He said that Black Power for the African-American community was not about doing whatever you wanted to do. He said it was much more about becoming who it is that you should be. For him, Black Power was an attitude, a dignity, a sense of self-worth that pursued the fullest potentials of an individual life. And yes, James Caan believed that the white community in America, that included the white church, had kept that from happening. The second theme that he came up with was the whole notion of Black theology. And what he meant by that was this: the Black community needed to discover a faith, a theology, in which their situation was analyzed, addressed, and improved by the faith that they held. James Caan was a Christo-centered theologian. And what that means is this: for him, as a Christian, Jesus was at the core of everything. And for him, the core of Christ, as it addressed the meaning of theology, had to do with creating the resources by and through which self-identity, self-worth, the fact that you were somebody mattered. And so for him, Black theology is a belief system by and through which African Americans could achieve those goals. What did that theology look like? Number one, it addressed the purposes of faith. What was the gospel? What was the message of the Christian faith? He concluded that indeed the message, the gospel, the heart of the Christian message was one of liberation. It was one of freedom. It was one of being emancipated from all of the oppressions that keep the soul from having an attitude of value. For James Caan, the notion of Christian faith was not about the study of God. For him, the meaning of the Christian faith was the awareness that the God who was at the center of the Christian community was a God of liberation. And you know something? His idea holds some water. Let's talk about the Bible. And let's talk about what it is that we find in that Bible. Perhaps the most glaring issue has to do with the whole story of the Exodus. God was unwilling to simply allow Moses to be freed. God's challenge to Moses was, go down to Egypt and set my people free. If you look at the whole prophetic tradition that is inherent in the Old Testament, over and over again, there are the cries for human freedom and liberation spoken by Jeremiah and also by Isaiah. James Caan believed that the God of the Bible was indeed a God of liberation, a God of freedom, a God who set people free. Secondly, his Black theology believed that the fundamental sin of the human spirit is indeed racism. Now, we have to stop there and be very careful and try to truly understand what he meant by that. He was not eliminating other kinds of sins from the list. Of course not. What he was doing was identifying that racism is predicated upon the essence of sin. Pride, arrogance, hostility, brutality. For him, racism was the epitome of sin that was introduced into the world to break apart the significance of life. And he very much believed that the sin that needed to be addressed in the 20th century in America was the sin of racism. Let's talk a little bit about his understanding of Christ. I mentioned earlier that for him, Jesus was at the heart of the gospel. And he goes on to talk about how it is that as we read the New Testament and try to understand the life of Jesus, what do we discover? We discover that consistently, Jesus is identified with the captive, the object of prejudice, the one who is at the lowest common denominator of life, the one who has been delegated to a position of inferiority. Jesus identified with lepers. And if you know anything about the Old New Testament, you know that the leper, that was more than a skin disease. Leprosy suggested that there was something wrong with you, something wrong with your soul, something wrong with your very nature. And therefore, in the times of Jesus, lepers were required to carry a bell. And as they walked through crowded city areas, they were required to ring that bell and cry out this word, leper, leper, leper. James Cone suggests that Jesus's identification with that group of people suggests that he was willing to identify with the targets of the society. Oh, there's more. Isn't it interesting that we read and oftentimes quote the story of the Good Samaritan? And we have to understand the context in which Jesus used that parable. You might remember that an elder passed by the man on the road and went on the other side. You might also remember that a priest, a representative of the synagogue, came by and went around the other side. And thus we are left to remember that the person who came and stopped, cared for, and provided sustenance for the man who had been attacked was indeed a Samaritan. And Cone goes on to suggest that Samaritans in the time of Jesus were perceived as and treated as the African-American in the 20th century. They were less than, they were rejects. And the basis for the rejection had to do with their ethnicity. Over and over again, Jesus is identified with lepers. He's identified with Samaritans. And interestingly enough, he's identified with women who also were objects of degradation, prejudice, and sometimes violence. Therefore, James Cone suggests that if we are serious about naming Jesus as our Lord, it becomes necessary to identify with the Lord who identified with the least of these. Thirdly, his theology addresses what theologians call his concept of man. What constitutes human being? What constitutes human life? And quite clearly, for this theologian, life stands most healthy. Life is most affirmed. Life is most celebrated whenever life is emancipated to pursue its highest ambitions. James Cone believed that we are most human whenever we are freed, and added this, and we are most freed whenever we are able to identify with those who are not. If James Cone were alive today and we put to him the question, what constitutes in your theology a human being? His response would be, a human being is a life emancipated and freed to care about those who are still imprisoned. Finally, James Cone's theology very much is patterned after Karl Barth's theology. Karl Barth, as you all know, was a great Protestant theologian in the last century, wrote voluminously, and really did rescue so much of the Protestant tradition from some of the absurdities that had crept in over the years. And one of the great themes of Karl Barth's thinking is this: God always acts in history. Karl Barth reminded us that God is not the man upstairs. He reminded us that God was not someone who lives out there, but rather Barth taught us that God was within us, that perhaps we might even say that God was us. And then went on to say that in every generation, there is a moment and a people who demonstrate most clearly God's action in history. For Karl Barth, who matured and wrote most of his work during the Second World War, guess who Karl Barth identified as the people who were most reflective of God's participation in history? That's right. It was the Jewish nation. And why? We all know the answer to that question. The Jewish people, under the treachery and brutality and violence of Adolf Hitler, suffered enormous indignities, 6 million deaths. They were the lowest of the low. They were the people who were required to wear the badge that said, this person doesn't count. And Barth made the point that perhaps the meaning and the purpose and the intention of God for the 20th century was most focused in and through the people called Hebrews. James Cone suggests that in the latter half of the 20th century and the first decade of the 21st, indeed, perhaps the African-American community has become the context in which God seeks to participate in our history in a way that instructs that history and transforms it. For James Cone, the Black people, how they have been treated, what they have become, what they might become, was an understanding of God's participation in the history of the world. Finally, James Cone believed that as a culture moves closer toward lifting up the downtrodden, celebrating the rejected, redeeming and liberating the captive, the kingdom of God is truly built. For James Cone, the notion of the kingdom of God had to do for our time with addressing the sin of racism and providing for people of color the opportunities for development and self-worth. To his credit, James Cone began his thinking primarily in the context of the Black community. And as he lived and matured, and as he observed the history of the emerging history of the culture, guess what? James Cone began to include more and more people in that category. He began to talk about the necessity of fair treatment of Latinos. He became concerned before the news media did about the treatment of Asian Americans. He worked with a colleague, Rosemary Ruther, dealing with the issues of sexism. James Cone came to believe that Black power and Black theology are not about the pigment of one's skin. Much more, they are about the nature of one's soul. They are about the attitudes that one possesses. They are all about who we are in relationship to those who are less than we. And so today, James Cone is much more than an African-American scholar who wrote about the specific needs and crises of the African-American community. He is a Christian theologian who has written and spoken about the necessity for all of us to treat each other in ways that are uplifting and emancipating so that the kingdom of God can indeed come into our midst. And you know something? He's pretty Christian about that. He believes clearly in the creative historical God, Yahweh. He celebrates the wonder of Jesus, the great emancipator, and in fact goes on to suggest how it is that the cross, as the symbol of Christianity, is really about reminding all of us about the need to suffer with those who suffer. He certainly is a man of the book. He's a man of scriptural integrity. And best of all, he puts forth for us a model of what the kingdom might look like. And it's not about cathedrals. It's not about powerful denominational boards. It's not about creating a set of mores that a few agree are necessary. It is about creating the moments in history when a nation, a people, a community, downtrodden and rejected, are now lifted up and celebrated. One last comment. Just before he died, James Cone authored a magnificent kind of manifesto. And I think it speaks to the reality of the man and the value he offers to us. He wrote how it was that there was no doubt about the fact that he began his thinking and his work as an African-American. He very much models what Bernard Anderson, the great Old Testament scholar, once said, and that is that every person who looks at some level of content does so through the lens of their experience. And for James Cone, his experience as a little boy was, why is it that good Christian white people treat Black people so badly? In the manifesto, he talks about the fact that Black power and Black theology for him were indeed spoken through the lens of his experience, and then goes on to write how it is that his lens has changed. And now he looks at the realities of the world in history through the lens of humanity and how it is that we live with and treat one another. Where does that leave the Black church? Well, the Black church in America today, according to Henry Gates, is in flux, it's in transition. We don't have the Martin Luther Kings that we once had. But we do have men like Cory Booker, United States Senator from the state of New Jersey, who's an openly faithful man. We also have a fella down there in Georgia, Raphael Warnock, who was the pastor of the Ebenezer Church there, now a sitting United States Senator. You also have Charles G. Miller, who is the bishop or the coordinator of a magnificent church in Brooklyn, where over 5,000 to 6,000 people come every Sunday morning. There is in the Black church at this moment, according to Gates, a transition. that's beginning to happen when the Black church is beginning to understand that perhaps Cone was onto something. And that is, we need to have a higher level of self-dignity. We have to have a higher level of development. We have to think of ourselves as being somebody. And I might add to his manifesto these words: I'm not so sure those only apply to people of color or to the Black church. My notion is they apply to all of us. Those of us who live in, reside in, worship in the white church as well. Jesus came to set us all free, so that in turn, in the name of Jesus, we can free others. Well, I think I've gone over time, and I apologize. And I apologize for my enthusiasm, but I thought James Cone was a fitting way to end our time together. And so if you have some questions, I'd be glad to respond.
So I have made it possible so that people can unmute themselves. I've discovered all of the answers to how we get rid of problematic intruders. So I think we should be good to go. But if anybody has any questions, please speak up. Anybody here in the chapel? Just unmute yourself.
Yeah, what you've said in the last 10, 15 minutes is I've never thought about it that way, so thank you. It's a very insightful way to describe our motives for the work we're doing in Homewood. And we're working with a lot of the leaders of Homewood and with the ministerium that's 17 churches. And you've provided me a logic that will be really valuable. So thank you.
May I ask your name and what is your ministry, your work?
Well, I've been working in Homewood for 13 years. When I retired, I started to work with a pastor by the name of Eugene Blackwell. And that led to work. Do you know Eugene?
Yes, I do. I know the name.
Oh, well, unfortunately, he died.
Yes.
But that's led to working with what's called the collaborative, that are the leaders of Homewood, and Eugene introduced us to them. And the whole idea is to redevelop Homewood in a way that protects the most vulnerable. And as you probably know, most redevelopment happens in disadvantaged communities where the current residents are pushed out. And we're working with Ed Gainey. Fortunately, he'll be the new mayor, and that will help us make sure the most vulnerable are not pushed out. There's no question money's coming to Homewood. The question is what's done with it. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Appreciate it. And your work.
Anyone else? Bobby, anyone online?
No, well, I don't know if I have a question. I have a comment. I remember reading, and I'm struggling to remember the author's name. I know that he came and spoke at the seminary maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and he talked about the connection between the Holocaust and people of color in this country now. And he made a parallel between them. And I thought, when you were talking about that sort of transition in the mind of James Cone from the Jewish people to the Black people, I thought of this man. It might be Charles Welsh, something like that. Anyway, I didn't realize the part about the lepers wearing a bell and how that parallels to the Jewish people wearing the star. And I try to think about, for people of color, they don't actually have to wear anything. They are Black.
That's right.
That's their skin, right? But they don't have a choice about that. So I don't know. This is all very interesting, all these parallels coming together. I don't really have a question unless you have a recommendation for a book by James Cone that a beginner could read. I haven't read him, so.
I would not refer to you as a beginner. I think his greatest work is entitled Liberation. And it was one of the very first that he wrote. And I would suggest that as a, and again, I'm not suggesting that as a beginner book. What I'm suggesting is that it holds within it some of his most basic ideas and thought concerning Black power, certainly Black theology, to some degree, the Black church. And I think you'd find it interesting to read. Also, if I may, I think that we do need to look at the question that you raise in terms of saying that African-Americans today, they don't need a bell. And they don't need a Star of David on their shirt. The signal that there's something wrong with them is immediately seen in terms by the racist mentality, is seen as they are because they're Black. And I think you can extrapolate that out into all sorts of groups of people. Certainly, I think we're doing better, I'm told we're doing better. I don't know that to be sure. But, you know, I think a woman has faced the same kind of bias. Certainly people of sexual preference face the same kind of bias. We seem to have a capacity to either attach to or find a symbol, something that says that the person that we're looking at is less than. And to me, that's scary because, and I'm not trying to be cute about this or funny because it isn't funny. As I have grown older, I have begun to experience the reality that when you present yourself as being 82 years old, there are some assumptions that kick in there that are not terribly affirming. So that I think ageism is a reality in our culture that needs to be addressed. And a guy like James Cone makes us mindful of how vulnerable we all are to commit two things: participate in using those symbols to denigrate a person. And number two, to realize that the day could come when that same methodology could be used about and against us. And the building of the kingdom of God, it seems to me, according to James Cone, is to in fact, eliminate that kind of fundamental thinking in our culture. And certainly in the theological world, that is something that needs to be addressed as well. Thanks for your comment. Liberation.
I'll just add to that. The bell of the Star of David, I think, gets back to the fundamental source of a lot of sin, which is to identify people as the other. And fundamental to what Jesus had to say to us is his admonition that there are two things that you need to do. One is love God, the other is love your neighbor. Well, we're not really loving our neighbor if we call them the other, if we call them less than. And if there's a visible sign that makes them less than, that makes it easier. It really doesn't matter whether it's a person's body size or their disability or their age or the color of their skin or their gender or what. We are almost wired to identify people and generalize and make assumptions just because it makes life easier. It also makes life more painful.
And if I could offer this note, I don't mean to cut questions off, but I want to stick this in as we move toward closure. One of the things that I am really grateful for in my life is the exposure that I've been privileged to have to young men and women we call students. And as I look at students today, as I listen to them, as I talk with them, as I teach them, as I read their work, I think our young men and women of today have begun to break through some of these things. Because the young men and women that I encounter, of course, I get it. There are losers in every age and in every culture and every system. I'm sorry. I wish you could avoid that, but you can't. Okay. So I understand there are some kids out there that are alcoholics, that are drug addicts, that don't get a job. I get that. Okay. But I'm saying the great majority of young men and women that I encounter in the collegiate setting are people, they don't see color anymore. They don't see gender anymore. They don't see age anymore. They see people. And more than that, they see people who share a commonality, and that is we all wish to live a full and meaningful life. So take heart. Take heart. We are not living in the last days. I think we are living in an era that offers us enormous challenges to continue the work of building the kingdom that might be also called the community, which might be called the neighborhood, which might be called the church, in which people can come together in ways that are efficacious and in ways that are supportive and meaningful. I just need to tuck that in there.
I agree with what you said about young people. Why do you think that's true?
Well, I wish I had a succinct answer to that, but I don't. But I have a couple of thoughts. The first one is, I think they have witnessed in the lives of perhaps their parents, grandparents, or other individuals, that the ways of bigotry and hatred and judgment don't work. Sooner or later, they fall. You know, they're not sustainable. So I think that the young men and women today have realized their own personal histories relevant to how people are treated. That's the first thing. They realize that the biases and the symbols and the violence directed against those biases and symbols, ultimately they destroy the very nature of life for everyone. The second thing is, I don't think that young people today are as plastic as the generations that have gone before them. And what I mean by that is they're not really impressed with designer clothes. They don't worry about making sure you have the right kind of car. They're not caught up in those kinds of things. Now, that doesn't mean they don't enjoy good things and a nice life and fun. No. It just means that they don't define them. So I think that young men and women today are much more, how would I say, basic in their understanding of what makes a life meaningful. And here's another interesting word, successful. And number three, I kind of think that I'm loath to say this, Ted, but after our experience this morning, I think that social media, hey, look, we all get it. I mean, we saw what can happen this morning with social media. It's fraught with difficulties. I get that. However, there are also advantages. And I do think that the exposure that the social media creates, as well as the opportunity to interface with people or positions different from theirs, has been an enormous value to young men and women today. I was sharing with a friend yesterday that teaching online is something I thought I'd never do, because I maintained the notion that somehow there's only one way to do that, and that is person to person. Now, if you unpackage that, that's what's meaningful to Jack. And what I've learned is that students today, because of their familiarity with computers and Zoom calls and all the rest of it, they are much more comfortable really opening up and saying what's in their heart by way of this medium than perhaps they are coming to the office. One student said to me, you know, Doc, I'm much more comfortable talking with you about, and in this case, it was his alcoholism. Talking with you about my alcoholism without coming to your office. Because when I come to the office, he said, I feel like I'm going to the principal's office or to the doctor's office, neither of which suggests health. So I think for those reasons, young men and women today are very hopeful for those of us whose days are limited. Yeah.
So I'm going to leave it on that hopeful note with for the recording and stop the recording, but not cut off the questions if anybody has any more. Thank you so much. This has been an excellent month of discussions, and I have learned so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Ted, and thank you all for allowing me to communicate this way and